Okay, as you know, the chair asked me to stand in for hopefully just half an hour. We were at the point, Mr. Gawula, you were still responding on some of the points. Yeah, could you carry on then?
Thanks, Honourable Chair. we engaged previously before we broke off for lunch in terms of the status of client departments not cooperating, us not able to sort of respond to the challenges that we faced when it comes to opportunity litigation, made reference to social development matters, made reference to home affairs matters. Another question was with regard to Unyathi. I gave a background what happened to Unyathi, and now the current status with Unyathi matter is that the state shouldn't have opposed that application from the High Court. That alone would be the Supreme Court of Appeal and consequently the Constitutional Court. And the cost during that protracted period of litigation was astronomical, in the sense that it exposed how government broadly manage and coordinates litigation. The current status thereof is that we were given until 31st August 2011 to amend Section 3 of the State Liability Act and also to bring about changes with respect to the 18th Constitutional Amendment Bill. And we're in the process sort of to sort of engage in those processes, consultations, and so on. But the legal profession has got a huge interest, especially when it comes to the State Liability Act. Now, the order of the judgment as it stands now is that if a debt funding adjustment order funding in money is not effected within 30 days by a respective client department, then the creditor must go to the Department of Treasury, relevant Treasury, national or provincially. And Treasury got 14 days to certify that that judgment. If they don't certify the judgment, then they can approach the court for relief in terms of attaching that property. What it means is that they can bring an application to a court to attach that property, but they've got 20 days to allow the other party to respond whether to execute that judgment or not. After the period of 20 days have expired, then they can go to the judgment debtor to sort of attach. And when they attach, they've got 14 days upon which to attach, but not to remove physically the property, because they can only attach in terms of movable property. And within that 14 days, if there's no response in terms of application to apply to stay those proceedings, then they can physically remove, in other words, to effect that order. Now, it has huge implications for the state. People are helping themselves move property of the state, and as government, we can't allow that. Now, the matter is not solely in the hands of the Department of Justice, because as the order stands now, client department has got responsibility to ensure that they satisfy those court judgments until such time we have brought about changes with regard to those two pieces of legislation. That has given us a bit of a wake-up call in terms of us failing to comply broadly as government with court orders in general. And the Constitutional Court, as Honourable Member Swart has made reference to some of the paragraphs made by the Chief Justice with regard to the conduct and the behavior of government with respect to those matters, is something that is highly not to be ignored by members here. Today, the Minister is briefing Cabinet on the implications, as alluded to, with regard to the Unyathi matter. Another question that related to outstanding judgments, especially in the Pretoria High Court, on intellectual property related cases. There is a practice, especially in Pretoria, where litigants put the matter on the roll. When the matter is ripe for a hearing, they look which judge is allocated that matter. And in most cases, you find that it's one of these acting judges, or, to be quite precise, a black judge. And it's a question of an intellectual property right that is in dispute. Intellectual property law, it's one of the specialized areas of law which very few practitioners, especially black practitioners, are available in this country. Then when they see if someone whom they deem to be incompetent to deal or adjudicate properly on this matter, then they appear in court and say parties have agreed to remove the matter of the law. Then what they use is alternative dispute resolution. They use a different method to circumvent the normal adjudication process through normal courts. And that process is taking momentum. It's taking momentum in the sense that there's a body that is currently has been constituted by other countries. Some countries in the SADC, Mauritius is one of the leading countries, being predominantly coordinated by a group of senior white legal practitioners, where they refer to this is Africa ADR, Africa Alternative Dispute, especially when it comes to economic related litigation. So that's the reason why some of the matters are outstanding with the country of judgments and how they circumvent that process. Another issue is,
stop you there. I mean, what do you mean that's the reason why judgments are outstanding? I mean, once the matter is heard, there's a judgment. You're talking about withdrawal of matters that go the ADR route. I don't understand the link at all.
What I'm referring to is that the judgments that are outstanding with regard to intellectual property rights disputes relates to judgment that were allocated to mostly acting judges, who does not have necessarily the skills and competence to adjudicate or in depth knowledge of that particular area. But it's not only those judgments that are outstanding in those cases. So I want to remember my specific reference to those ones. So it's a different one than a matter being withdrawn from the role. So I'm just making that distinction there.
Yeah, what are you then saying about it? Because I can understand the ADR people wanting to go the ADR route, but that would be presumably before they get to trial. I'm not sure the issue of raising the ADR issue when it comes to waiting for judgments. Presumably the issue is that, I mean, when the judge produces their judgment is unfortunately up to the judge, not the department. And those would be matters that would have to be taken up with the JP of that province. And is there any role the department can play in that regard? But am I not right that it's actually a judicial matter?
That's correct. As we understand, the JP is the head, of course, and he's the one that is seized with that responsibility.
The question would be, is the department monitoring how long it takes to deliver judgments?
I can't say with certainty whether taking account from where I sit that there's a system or the process to monitor those outstanding judgments.
This is a question put by Ms. Michael. Apologies, but and to you too, Chair. Was this Ms. Michael's question? I'm afraid she's just had a fall. I've just taken her to for some medical attention, so that's why she's not here. Yes, the question surely would be, should the department be monitoring anything the judges do? And my answer would be no. Chair, you didn't hear Ms. Michael has had a fall, unfortunately. I've taken her to the nurse. We will see with the nurse. She may not be back, therefore. So the answer to the question why our judgment's outstanding is that they were allocated to acting judges who couldn't handle the subject matter. Is that crisp answer.
That's correct in the main.
Sorry, Ms. Sedgwick-Silva, you laughed when, I thought you laughed when I asked about monitoring, and you are courts, acting court services. Do you want to? Maybe you weren't laughing, but do you have any comment to make?
On the issue that was discussed,
whether the department should be monitoring
yes.
the issue of judgments.
Yes, the comment I would like to make is that it is difficult for the department to do that because, as my colleague has already indicated, that matter falls within the judge president or the head of the court. And when we raise those issues as part of case flow management to monitor case cycle time, they view that as encroaching on the independence of the judiciary, that we are encroaching on their judicial function as such. So it's a challenge that we are facing when it comes to case flow management to do that. But from a system, purely system point of view, the system that we are developing and having in place are able to give us a cycle time. But it is difficult to really take them and make them accountable as a department as such. That's the point the comment I would want to make.
Okay. I mean, maybe just some discussion on it, because the judges are independent, but if you look at the there is a problem of judgments taking too long, and it's not just intellectual property; it's a range of judgments for various reasons. And obviously, the individual member can take it up, but I think very often practitioners don't want to take it up because they're worried that here they are waiting for the judge to deliver a judgment, and they're going to then kick up a fuss that this judgment is late. Maybe it will affect which way the presiding officer decides to rule. I would have actually thought it is useful monitoring. I mean, the department is monitoring court hours and things like that. So I think it would be useful to collect those statistics. And if you don't feel you want to supply the Chief Justice or the JP with them, the relevant JP, then to supply us. Because otherwise what do other members of the committee feel? Because otherwise it just carries on, because the affected people are too scared to raise it because they worry the judge will then get irritated with them and rule against them. And it just carries on, and it's not right that the people can. I know of one judge it's not an intellectual property related matter, where I think it's 3 years. It's actually JP, but anyway.
Chair, there would be no harm in the department asking possibly the Association of Law Societies for a breakdown. Their members would know what, and then it excludes that predicament that members might find. But I personally don't think there's a problem if the department is monitoring it. I'm also aware that when you appoint, it's the executive that appoints acting judges. The minister appoints the acting judges. Is that not so? There's no Judicial Services Commission involvement there, and I think we're talking about acting judges here, and I think it might be important for the department to advise the minister if a particular acting judge is not delivering judgments, because why would he then be appointed? I appreciate Ms. Smuts's concern about separation, and I share that as well. But particularly when it comes to acting judges, I think there needs to be some monitoring mechanism without infringing the separation of powers. However, we can debate that, how one can do that.
Any other comments? Does anyone else first before Ms. Smuts? Ms. Adams?
I'm still waiting for more questions to be answered.
Oh, just hang on. We're on this point of the judgment. Anyone else on the judgments then? Okay.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, the normal practice is actually in High Court, you write to the JP asking for a judgment. So what my advice now is, the department can approach the JPs or the head of the magistrate about these outstanding judgments. And then if now they don't found, they don't get a reasonable answer, they may come out to the Portfolio Committee to pick it up.
Maybe, Ms. Smuts, before
I wanted to offer a last possibility, is that the JSC, which now has a broad range of duties, may offer another option, but it would need thinking about.
It's following from Mr. Ntapane. Why can't the department look at mechanisms to get information over judgments that take longer than, I don't know what the figure would be, 6 months. I think that is probably fair. I don't know, but find a figure. And I'm sure you can get that information from the courts. The problem with Ms. Matsa's suggestion of the JSC is, as Mr. Ntapane has also raised, is also the magistrate's courts. And then to maybe not to alert us proactively or anything, but to supply us with that information as part of your annual report. I mean, you supply information on court hours, which is effectively also saying to the judges, are you working, putting in enough hours? Just supply us in the normal course of events, and hopefully they would then start seeing, and we can pick up in those reports that there are problems and start raising it. Mr. Swart?
We also have that opportunity to meet with the judiciary as well, where we're not necessarily exercising any oversight, but we could raise concerns in that regard, and we can engage with them when we have that meeting as well, if we have that information.
Okay, can you look at that and then respond? Mr. Gianni, you want to respond now?
Or? See, I just wanted to say that I think it would be very helpful if we could just get the particulars of that case, so that from here we can follow up and be able to give you a response on it. But I do agree on the establishment of a monetary mechanism that also would include those kind of issues. I think it is something that is doable. Mm.
Carry on then. And then remember Ms. Adams is waiting in the wings.
I'm going to respond to the question. Your question related to the judgment that has been delivered given against the state. The current system that we use now does not create an opportunity for us to sort of have an inventory of the judgments against the state. But with effect from the next financial year, 1st April, our NOC system, National Operational Center, will be able to assist us in terms of gathering those statistics. And also the cost of your second question, part of
on that. How come there's no inventory if you have state attorney's offices in all the different provinces? I mean, surely you can get it from them. Are the ones that deal with it?
That's correct. But the current template that we use to collect that data, we did not make provision to sort of look at all judgments. It's only, as I say, with effect from 1st of April. Your second leg of the question was with reference to the cost of the judgment that are still outstanding. You'd recall that in terms of the judgment of the 9th of October in the Nyathi matter, we were required to go back to the Constitutional Court to report on from the list of 219 outstanding judgments that the state has not paid. Sometime in October, prior to the judgment given, that number was reduced to 17. Currently, I can safely say that there are about 17 outstanding judgments, and the majority of those judgments are matters that relate to the South African Police Services and the Department of Health. And the cost thereof, it was reduced from, I think, 37 million rand to about 3 million rand. I'm not sure whether other members responded to all your questions.
Those 17 cases, are those cases that were also instituted in this year and finalized in this year, or were they all old cases?
What the approach taken by the Constitutional Court was that it called upon the profession, the law society in particular, that they must give a list of judgments that they receive in favor against the state. And initially, it was a list of about 200. Judgments on money dating back from 1996-97 until to date. So the list of 17, I cannot specifically say it's for this current year or it's for the previous financial year. Unless I can look that up and then provide members with that information.
maybe the easiest is come back to us with that. And then particularly Mr. Nyati or Mrs. Nyati, I'm not sure if it was male or female, Mr. Nyati, has that one been paid?
The unfortunate part, when the payment was finally made to him, he already deceased.
The estate then?
The estate, yeah.
But that's been paid?
Yeah, that's been paid.
Maybe, sorry, while we're still on Nyati and the, you spoke about the minister going to cabinet, but you had to get an extension from the Constitutional Court on this. And I think it would be useful that we start getting reports from the department as well as to how far are you with the state liability bill. So again, not necessarily now, and presumably you'd want to get the, you'd want to include the minister's report to cabinet and what cabinet has said. But I think it would be important early in the new year to get a report as to where is it, so we don't have a problem of Parliament being asked to finalise the bill in a few months.
We will do that, thanks.
The judgment was in 2008 and we were given until 2009 to implement. You then had to get it extended.
Time frame was 31st July, am I right, Dion? 31st July 2008, for us to sort of go back to the Constitutional Court and say 2009, yeah, June 2009.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm understanding Ms. Smuts correctly, but she's saying, well, it's 2011, but that's no guarantee. So I think we do need a report by early in the new year as to where is this bill, when is it coming to us.
Thanks. The last question by a member was the huge amounts that the state is paying to private practitioners and whether it is not possible for the Department of Justice to create competitive salaries or good salaries to attract the people currently benefiting from the legal services of the department. There is a process that started in 2007 where we looked at creating sort of a framework upon which the state broadly can save on litigation costs. And the process currently was piloted by sort of employing a few number of individuals in the department to sort of assist in litigating matters on those bases. What I can safely say now is that we're still trying to investigate whether that pilot project is a value for money. Secondly, and whether can we create a framework to sort of have those people in the department being employed by the department to try to reduce the cost of litigation at state expense. And currently, I must say, there's no legal framework or policy framework that makes provision in terms of drawing people from there and creating them in the department rather than appointing or employing someone from in the ordinary course of recruitment process. I'm not sure whether I've covered all the questions raised by members.
To members, any further questions? Mr. Ntapane, I can see your hands.
Yes, sir. The acting DC said something about bail regime. And then I put a question that actually he was complaining about people who commit crimes now and again. And so you have intention of amending now. The Criminal Procedure Act, I think so. If I'm right, I don't know whether I heard him right. And then my question was, is that Schedule 6 offences not enough to keep an accused person in custody? And then secondly, propensity to commit further crimes is also a ground for refusing bail and resistance right now. Is that not also a remedy, rather than amending the law?
I'd like
Mr. Gawula, don't respond, I'd like to. There were some other hands coming up, so can I just get all the additional questions, Ms. Smuts?
I'll have to check whether Natasha and Michael's questions on maintenance and Weinberg were answered. If they were answered, I will ask after the time.
You see, part of the problem is this is Ms. Gawula's litigation. Some of these questions are court services. I would have thought that's a court service.
Are we dealing with
Well, it's been Mr. Gawula on the floor.
Yes, and in the second round of questions, then for clarity, in the second round of questions, will we still be allowed to ask?
Sure, look, I don't think we're restricting, but we've still got to get to court services.
Yeah.
So I think, are there any other questions on litigation? That's, in other words, cases, court cases in which the department or government is a party.
Yeah. Briefing private counsel is obviously a difficult issue because you obviously don't want to lose cases, and you can have the impression, like with the legal aid board, that a lot of people say it's the second-rate lawyers that are doing it, which I do not agree with. But obviously there will always be a need, and of course there's a huge need to empower private black advocates. That's part of the mandate as well. So you've got to strike that balance between the two. And I think that's obviously something that we'd be interested to follow up. So just to say that it's very easy just to say we must employ all the councils, but it's not that easy. The state is the biggest litigator, the biggest private state litigator in the country. So you will always have cases that are complex that require private top advocates. You are going to have those disbursements. But I think when I chatted to you over lunch, the important point is that 265 million comes back to the department. And I think that's an important point to be made, that whilst the department pays those advocates now, it's an agency function. And those client departments paid back. So it's not a disbursement from the department. So I just encourage you in that regard. You are seeking to strike that balance, but don't be too hasty to employ a lot of counsel. That at the end of the day, you know, your client departments might be unhappy. And then they want to brief private lawyers themselves. Thank you.
We've recently seen in the press a number of black advocates saying, why aren't you employing us if you want black judges in the engine? That looks quite good.
Thanks, Chair. In summary, to comment further on the issue raised by Honourable Member Swart, is that you're right, it is a difficulty when we've got to make use of private counsel, because the current practice now, the initial practice, the old Treasury regulations was that the state attorney will decide who to appoint in a particular matter. But it has been changed over the years. The current problem that we're experiencing as state attorneys is that client instructs you to brief counsel X, Y, and Z. And the central advice to client that you've looked at the matter, this matter is complicated, I've worked with counsel X, Y, and Z, but I feel counsel ABC is better to deal with this matter, you've dealt with this matter before, and so on. And then you get a sharp criticism that we're paying the bill, I'm client, I'm giving instructions. Or otherwise, as the court will say, I'll take the matter to a private, I'll instruct the private attorney to prove the counsel that I prefer as counsel. Now, one of our measures to try to deal with that in the blueprint, which is a policy document, we say it's going to be a state attorney's decision in consultation client department to appoint counsel. And so far, in the comments that I've received, we have not, it hasn't been criticized, and that's why the minister today will have to sort of make that statement quite bold, because it's got room for corruption, if you understand what I mean. And an official in client department continuously briefing X, Y, and Z, X, Y, and Z, X, Y, and Z. And there's not a perception between the relationship of an official investigation client department and this particular preference on insistence of one and the same client advocate to utilize. And also the insistence of state attorney on one hand to continuously go against the client instruction by insisting briefing one on the same person to deal with that matter. For example, we see the papers that there are certain client departments that prefer to use particular counsel because of their expertise, for example, in constitutional law. Whereas there are other black competent senior advocates that are able equally to rise to the occasion to deal with those matters. So it's a question of having this policy directive adopted by Cabinet, and then we're able to resolve some of our problems. Thanks.
Can we move on? Let's move to, I haven't forgotten your question, Mr. Ntapane. You'll see how I'm suggesting we deal with it. I think if we can deal then to court services, and Mr. Gianni, maybe you need to, as sort of former head of that section, you need to indicate what you'll do and what your successor will do. But maybe start with the Mr. Ntapane's question on the bail. You had spoken yourself about the amendment to the bail law. And then also linked to that, there was reference to a bail protocol, which I think you said was coming into effect in, was it August? I don't have the document in front of me, but if you can indicate what's happening with the protocol and how that is addressing things. But can we start then with the bail issue and then move on to court services more generally?
Okay, Chair, just on the bail protocol, I think the protocol has been signed. I think it's in operation as we speak at the moment, and we are busy monitoring the effective implementation of it by all departments that are involved on this. I think on the bail regime, firstly, the existing provision of the Criminal Procedure Act does give a remedy to the current scenario. I think in terms of the Schedule 6, it has a list of those matters that would make it difficult for people to get bail. The issue that I was making reference to was, is it a response to the current trends, especially in cases where we have very serious suspects that have previously been granted bail and who, when released again, commit offences and come back. So one of the issues that we are still debating within the cluster, and I must say this is also not something that is public knowledge at this stage because we are still looking at the constitutional aspect of this.
It is a public meeting, you know that, so whatever you're going to say is then going to be...
Now, Chair, I was just because I was quoted in the radio, I think, during lunchtime, and I just became a bit agitated that I think this thing, I thought it was still within this house, and yeah. But the issue there, I think we are proposing what is called a three strike bail provision, which suggests, I think, amongst others, that if we are one of the repeat offenders, for example, in PED, we have been given one chance to go out on bail, and subsequent to that, again, commit another offense, and then we'll end up, I think this is the majority of cases that I think currently we have experienced, especially the high, very risk cases. So what we are proposing, of course, there is that, you know, people that have been given previous opportunities should find it more difficult to get bail again, especially those that have committed serious offences. So it's still a discussion thing, and it's not as yet concretized, but I think it is our response to see exactly what needs to be done to tighten the existing legislative provision of the Criminal Procedure Act with regard to bail. It's part of the research because, as you know, the Criminal Justice Review, one of the mandates, we also had to research the existing legislation and policies to see whether there is any need to change the current legislative framework. So this, what I'm talking about, is part of the outcome of that research that suggests that perhaps we need to tighten a little bit our bail laws. Thanks.
Can we move on to court services then generally, Ms. Senwer, do you want to
Thanks, Chair.
Respond to the questions? Thanks.
Thanks. Just to add to what the acting teacher has already said on bail, the implementation of the bail protocol also entails that whenever the prison is overpopulated, the head of prison can make an application to have the case taken to be reviewed.
So that's
the bail can be either reduced or the person can be let out on bail, etc. Those are the details of what the protocol entails, how the role players will deal with that. I'll move to the other question which was raised on the video remand.
Before that, wouldn't it not be good for us to get a copy of that protocol? I mean, it's a public document, isn't it?
Okay.
Can we get a copy of it?
I'll arrange that. I'll move to the next issue, or the next question that was asked was on video remand, and I'll deal also with the other questions together raised on how the IT is reflected in the presentation. What does it seek to respond to in terms of solutions? The video remand system, as the member had asked, honourable member had asked, seeks to alleviate the problems that most of the resources of the courts are spent in bringing accused to court just for purposes of remand, which, if you look at the administrative burden cost and the time it takes for the person to appear, is very huge in terms of the resources. But the time spent, is, we have measured it, is less than 5 minutes for a person to appear and leave. But when we implemented the system, that was the rationale behind that we cut the cost, because the police must have the cost to prepare the people to take to prison, and there is a long administrative process in prison to take the people outside to go to court, which has its own hurdles. And the cost of having to spend time just on remand in the court, which is on court hours too. So the intention behind that was that using technology, can't we have the person sitting in prison and we categorize in terms of which category of accused persons we are going to deal with. It will be people who are above 18, or people whose cases are definitely not going to be going on trial, and people whose cases are not having issues, like a person wants to maybe complain to the minister, to the presiding officer, that I have this injury, this and that, where there are no issues, and there are behind-the-scenes preparation that makes sure that those cases don't have those issues. It's a mere case of somebody appearing because of the case was on the roll and it's going to be postponed. So the technology that has been put in place is that there will be a technology in the prison where the person will come into this room on video conferencing system, which is also in the court, and the magistrate will be able to see the person in the prison and speak to him or her through technology like you do with VCC normally, yes, CCTV. So that's how it happens, and then where the accused has got a lawyer, there is infrastructure also at the court so that they can communicate in private between to protect the lawyer and client privilege to deal with that. We piloted it in KwaZulu-Natal in two courts linked to Westville, just as a pilot to be able to learn the lessons from there. And we are in the process of expanding it for rollout in the other courts across the country. But we are not really full-fledged with the rollout. The legislation relating to that addresses the legal issues was passed, I think, through the House last year, and it is in place. The regulations are being developed in that sense. So in a nutshell, the intention was to make sure that we cut the costs and the administrative burden on the police and prisons, as well as the court itself, to waste much more time on cases which are in any way not going to be going on trial. In addition to that, the question on issues of IT and what is it that it seeks to achieve, I think we have listed in the presentation some of the IT solutions in the court which are case management related, one being the DCRS system, which is the digital case recording system, which intends to replace the analog, the old tape, analog system that we used to record cases in, which had its own challenges in relation to the fragility of the tapes themselves, etc. So we have replaced that old system with that, because with the new system of digital that we have, it also has scalability in terms of being able to move towards a central archiving of our records, which we are not that there yet, but we are moving in that direction in that sense. The e-scheduler is another system that was referred to, and seeks to register the cases in the system, in the courts. We have started with that in the criminal courts, in the district courts. The intention being that we should be able to have a central database where our cases are recorded, so that we are able to manage case flow from a central point of view. So that has been implemented, which will also, as part of the CJ's review, be linked to other systems like the CAS system in the police, etc., to be able to draw other information. So in a nutshell, the e-scheduler is trying to register cases so that we are able to have management reports from which we are able to manage cases from. On the issue of the civil courts in the the high case role in the civil courts in Pretoria? Why is it too high? And whether is it a fact that the rough cases are contributing to that problem? I think members should also take into consideration that the Southern Division has concurrent jurisdiction with concurrent with the South, Joburg and Pretoria. So in most cases, litigants or lawyers will choose where they want to go, and most of the time you will find that for one reason or the other, they prefer to go to the North, and it clogs the system in that sense. The second issue also is that the jurisdiction of the North Division also stretches beyond Limpopo and the other provinces in that sense. And I think also, as Gauteng is very clear in our case management system, that Gauteng carries the highest workload in the country because it's the hub of our economy, that's where it's driven from. So it has that tendency of having high workload as such, besides the issue that it has jurisdictional issues attached to it. In addition, I think it is a fact that the rough cases are also affecting the civil high court, generally not only limited to housing. And I think it's a matter that the heads of courts have already taken up with the minister to ask the department to look at how we can be able to alleviate that pressure out of that. And we are exploring other mechanisms. The department is already engaging with the Department of Transport to be able to see how with the RAF we can partner to find other mechanisms to alleviate that pressure, because we have a case, an instance in the past where there was a project between the RAF and other service providers to deal with that, to find a mechanism where cases which can be settled outside the court system can be dealt with unless it's required to be going back to the court. That was piloted in the Cape Division, the Western Cape Division. So we are looking at that, but it is a fact that the rough cases are really picking up the caseload. The other issue that was raised was with regard to the Magistrate Court Pretoria. There's a pedestrian whose case was postponed 14 times, a mere accident case. I would like maybe to want to have the details so that one can be able to look at that and be able to respond appropriately to that, if the Honourable Member has got the details on that.
That Honourable Member is the one that's not here, so if Ms. Smuts can remind her to supply you the details.
Thanks, Chair. The other issue related to court dates not being available, I think also it was a general case, but I think it is already covered by what I've said with the High Court in Pretoria specifically, that because of the high workload, obviously then the turnaround time in terms of court days becomes longer and longer. And in that sense, it's an issue that the judge presidents especially are grappling with in the High Court and the rest of the other courts.
Let's ask on the jurisdiction issue. I mean, the intention is to split Gauteng into two divisions. That would presumably be legislated when the Superior Court's bill is finally tabled and through, or tabled again and through. Is there any plan in the interim to resolve the problem of the concurrent jurisdiction between the North and the South? And then I suppose linked to that it's linked to the question of the building at Limpopo. What's happening with the Limpopo jurisdiction? We do have a high court at Toyando, the former Venda High Court. But what steps are you taking to try and resolve this jurisdiction problem? I don't know if you can answer now, but if you can, fine. Otherwise, come back to us.
Okay, thanks, Chair. We will come back with the details, but one of the plans that we have in place to deal with that jurisdictional issue is, you remember the circuit court in Mpumalanga, sorry, in Limpopo, which has been put into place to try and alleviate the pressure of the North and the South Division cases in that respect. Unfortunately, the Superior Court Bill, as you've already members already indicated, Chair, will resolve that issue, but it could be a long or medium or long-term
solution. But the Limpopo Circuit Court will deal with that. Only vendor or the Limpopo High Court now, as it has been renamed, unfortunately, the legislation provides for jurisdiction only within the original area of jurisdiction. It is not expanded beyond that. So I'm still sitting with that problem that the jurisdiction issue cannot be resolved. The name has been changed, but we can't expand its jurisdiction beyond that. And it is a superior court bill which is intended to deal with that, to make sure that it opens it up. But in the meantime, we still do not have a solution in that line.
Are you correct on that? I mean, and Mr. Swart, you were there. I don't, Professor Ndabandaba, I'm not sure if you were whether it was during your absence. But you know, we had the problem with the Ciskei High Court wanting to sit at East London, and my understanding is that we passed legislation to allow it to extend its jurisdiction. So if that is the case, why can't that same legislation be used to expand the jurisdiction of the Toyando Court?
We'll check with that. I don't know if Mr. Ratman is seized with the matter, but it's something that I will have to check.
Gianni, you look as though you want Mr. Ratman. Mr. Ratman?
I thought he could respond on this. I think there is a proposal that we are proposing for the interim, especially with regard to the circuit courts. We want to give it a local division status, so that but under the North Gauteng, so that people then can start litigating, because currently, you know, in spite of the opening of the court, people still travel to Pretoria for civil matters. So the proposal that we're looking at, I think that legislation advises to look at what proclamation that the minister or anyone that has those powers, that we could amend the current local circuit court and establish a local division for the North Gauteng in Polokwane.
Chair, that legislation, as you indicated, was for a specific problem in the Ciskei, but I'm sure it creates the possibility that one can look also at the other divisions and other high courts to see whether one can perhaps extend their jurisdiction as well.
Yeah, I don't remember being the Ciskei High Court bill. I think it was general, and then a proclamation was issued specifically to refer to the Ciskei. But I think the issue that Mr. Gianni also alludes to is high courts have to be established for Limpopo and for Malanga. High courts are not just in a building. You've got to start building up. So in the interim, what are you doing to start establishing the Limpopo High Court and the Mpumalanga High Court? Don't answer that now. You're not prepared, but come back to us on that one, please. But anyway, carry on.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chip. The other question related to the backlog, and the question was whether we have any, what is our strategy and plans in dealing with the backlogs and issues of the baseline, etc. I think the members have noted the project that the department started since November 2006 to deal with the backlogs, although it is confined to the regional courts, and the progress that has been made. The plan is that we will extend it to the district court within the financial year, before the end of the financial year in March, because we also have many backlogs in the district courts. And the head of course have also alluded that we need to also look at the high courts in that sense. So we are planning to move firstly to the district courts and also with the high courts. In the district courts, we're looking at cases which are trial ready and are older than 6 months, and the regional courts, you know, it's 9 months, and we'll look at 12 months or look at other areas in the high courts. So those are the plans that we have in place to deal with the backlogs, and it's still continuing as part of the criminal justice review to try and deal with the issues of the backlog and the pressure on the criminal justice system as such. The other question was on the
backlogs, Northern Cape and Limpopo. the explanation for the increase in the backlogs.
May I come back to you on that, Chairperson? I don't have the details at this stage. Can I ask my colleague Michael to take the issue on the statistics, and we'll follow up on that.
So about the Ms. Michael's questions on the maintenance.
Yes.
Court duty. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Michael Ndopovani. I'll respond basically to the concern that has been raised around the high number of cases that have been removed and in terms of trying to explain what are we doing about it. So far, the focus has been really in terms of how, as a department, do we reduce sort of like the cases that are being withdrawn. And for that, the colleagues from the prosecution have introduced better screening mechanisms. And as a result, you'll see that has assisted in the reduction of cases that are being withdrawn. As you can also see, they're within brackets as to what are actually all the other contributing factors towards the high removal of cases. There's also sort of like your cases that are being transferred, just to explain what that means, really. As you know, that your district court is a court of first instance. So you always have cases that have to be transferred from either district court to the regional court, and so that is what that transfer will sort of like reflect on. So there isn't much that one can do around that. And now in terms of we also sort of like track in terms of what actually happened to all the warrants that have been issued. And so far, over about 57%, on average, 57% of warrants that were issued, people were brought back to court yearly. Thanks.
Can I continue? Oh, the issue on the maintenance costs was why? Sorry? Oh. The question of...
Don't mind Ms. Much. She sometimes sort of matters to herself and to those around her.
Thanks, sir. The issue of why cases in the maintenance costs are non-operational, I think we as a department, we are aware of the pressure that we have around cases of maintenance, and we have in the last few years put an informal project in which the cases relating to maintenance were given specific attention to make sure that they are fast-tracked. So in that case, I think I would ask the house that I give a report on the maintenance statistics so that we are able to respond appropriately in terms of areas where there are pressure areas and issues of concern in that generally in the courts, for members to be able to interact and indicate specifically where the areas are so that we can also explain from a statistical point of view if it pleases the house.
You don't have to use court terminology here about pleasing the House. Are there any more, Prof?
Thanks, Chair. Could we get more details about the Solinger project?
Okay, sorry. I want to take now a new round, so don't answer them one by one. So Prof, Solinger project, Mr. Tapan.
Thank you, sir. Say the gentleman next to me regarding cases that have been struck off the road. He says the NPA screening process that has just started. I just want to find out when did this process started, because according to this judgment, 60%, 60.3% of the cases has been removed from the law. When did this start, this screening process by the NPA? Is it working based on this percentage?
Other questions on court services?
So on the absence of equipment to burn dockets onto CDs at Wynberg.
Can we get that as well? That's Wynberg, Joburg. The absence of the CDs to burn documents and cases apparently being thrown out for that reason. I think the problem is, following on from Mr. Tapane's question, I think the problem is that 60%, you've lumped so many things into it. So you've lumped transfers, where a case is not dead, it's just carrying on to another court or a more appropriate court with withdrawals. So it's a very confusing figure, and it would be much better to have broken it down. Yeah. But anyway, do you want to respond then on those points? And then, Mr. Rudman, I also saw you had your hand up, presumably to do a response or
There were a number of questions relating to legislation, but I'll...
Okay, let's come back to legislation, yeah. Let's finish court services.
On the question of Isondo is a project that the department identified because it realized that there is a problem with maintenance, in the sense that there is money lying in the coffers of the department which are not necessarily claimed by the beneficiaries who are not getting the benefit of that. Two, there were issues relating to beneficiaries not being traced. So Isondo was putting things to try and deal with that, to find the beneficiary as well as, on the other hand, try to find mechanisms to get the offenders, so to speak, who are not complying with the maintenance orders in that sense. So that was done in all the provinces to identify those cases where there are too much money lying so that they can be dispersed, and also find maintenance investigators to trace those people whose cases are not structured in the system. But we will include it in the report on the maintenance. Oh, sorry. Was looking at the wrong chair. Thanks, Stephen.
It's not the wrong chair at all. It's the right chair for this session. Well, okay. I think you are concluding.
Yes, so I was
not going to speak on this and according to my level. Thanks.
Please, quiet. The CD issues. Yes, we are aware of the problem with the CD cutting by the clerks in the courts. What we have done as a department is we are busy on a project to audit all the cases where there are missing records, either from the fact that the record is not being cut properly or the record is not produced, etc. There are various problems that relate to court records that we have identified in the courts. So each province has been tasked to do an audit of those cases so that we are able to identify whether the problems are systemic in terms of the machines not working, or if people's issues in terms of the clerks not being able to cut or not being able to be have the training enough to be able to run the machine and manage the record as such. So we are aware of that problem systemic in the courts. And specifically, if there are areas where those issues are brought to the members, especially the Rwandan issue, if we can have the details so that we can specifically look at that. But we are generally looking at that problem and we are aware of it.
Thanks. Just a small follow-up question on the Isondo project. Will your investigation spread its wings to the maintenance of ghost children? Ghost teachers who get paid but are not there.
I think by design that those such cases, if they are at all present, will come out, because if the people are being traced and the beneficiary are traced, then they will be presenting themselves and proper identification will take place to do that. But they will check with the regions whether there has been any such case identified.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure whether you would respond to my question about the World Cup and any specific mobile courts or anything like that. It's obviously a matter of interest. And then possibly Dion on the trafficking bill. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry about that. The plan in terms of the 2010 is in place. What we were struggling with was the funding in terms of the sub-programs, because all the courts that are going to be affected by the stadia where the matches will be played, where the jurisdictions have been identified. The plans in terms of the infrastructure to be prepared for that is in place. There is a subcommittee or steering committee that is looking across that with the police and other role players to look at that. But the plan is in place. We can share that with the House, but what we were struggling with was the issue of the budget. And it includes all issues relating to human resources, whether people work overtime, etc., whether we have sufficient legal prosecutors to deal with those cases, and issues of language, foreign interpreters, etc. So those plans are in place. We are just finalizing the budget issues. On,
issue of trafficking bill, I think Mr. Ratman will touch on that.
Thank you, Chair. There were a number of issues that were raised relating to legislation. Honourable Steve asked about the trafficking bill, trafficking in persons, and he wanted to know whether the bill will be ready before 2010. Now, the bill has been approved by Cabinet. It went to the State Law Advisors. We received the bill back from the State Law Advisors towards the end of last month. We are now looking at all the amendments that they proposed. Chair, once we've done that and advised the Minister as far as the amendments are concerned, we will introduce the bill into Parliament, and that should probably be within the next 2 or 3 weeks. That will then enable this committee to look at the bill early next year, or as soon as the committee meets.
Won't be, yeah, 2 or 3 weeks. will not be,
it'll be nice.
But
really,
maybe early in the year, yeah, let's just put it that way. We would, sorry, did you?
No, are we expected to pass this bill by the World Cup? And would it be, the other problem is we pass bills, but they take a long time to implement. Just if we could have some more detail about whether it's going to be worth passing it in terms of being implementable.
Well, of course, there are certain provisions that one can implement before 2010 if the committee approves the bill before 2010, especially the provisions relating to the prohibition and combating of trafficking. There might be other provisions that will require further implementation processes, which will probably not be possible to implement. But the main focus of the bill will be combating of trafficking in persons, and I'm sure those provisions will be able to be put into operation.
I'm also curious what some of the other provisions are that
may be
taking time to implement.
It's providing for a policy framework to deal with trafficking in persons, including bringing all departments together, a policy framework to deal with training of people, how to deal with trafficking, and a number of other issues. So those provisions might not be implementable by 2010. But that is what I'm actually saying, that those provisions will be able to be implemented.
I'm sure you're aware that there's a lot of public interest in that matter. And in fact, last night it was on television again. And I think we need to try to prioritize that as much as possible. And try to find a way of fast-tracking that legislation so that we can get at least the bare elements of what we need in place before the 2010 World Cup. Thank you, Chair.
I'm sure the point is made.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. There were also other issues raised by Honourable Jeffries. Firstly, it related to the implementation of legislation. The Honourable Jeffries indicated that he's been a member of this committee for 11 years, so he will know that we do have a document dealing with the implementation of legislation, and that deals with legislation since 1994, enacted by this Parliament. That document I will provide to the committee, updated document, and I will do so within the next week or so, and we can then, if so required, brief the committee on where we stand with the implementation of all the legislation since 1994. He referred to video remands, wanting to know whether we've dealt with that. The regulations have been drafted. We have received comments from role players. We are looking at those comments, and we hope to submit the regulations to our minister at the beginning of next month, with then also a recommendation on an implementation date. The Child Justice Act was also raised by the Honourable Jeffrey. We have formulated the regulations. The Act comes into operation on the 1st of April 2010, and we hope to have the regulations finalised by then. We have drafted the regulations. We've consulted with all departments and all role players. It has now been formally submitted to the ministers, the relevant ministers, in terms of the Act, for their comments, and depending on the comment, we will be able to then to finalise the regulations before the date of implementation. Oh, yes, and the minimum sentences. He also raised the issue of the minimum sentences. We reached a recent judgment of the Constitutional Court relating to children. We have drafted the amendments. We have submitted the amendments for comments. The amendments will be included in a Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, which will also be introduced into Parliament early in next year, probably the first half of the session of Parliament. The intention is to submit these amendments. It contains amendments to a number of acts to submit these amendments to the relevant role players. As far as the State Liability Bill is concerned, Chair, I think my colleague has indicated what where we stand with the bill. You will recall that a Constitution Amendment Bill and a State Liability Amendment Bill was published in the Gazette for comment. We received a large number of comments on those two bills, especially in regard to the Constitutional Amendment. I think there was perhaps some misunderstanding as far as that amendment is concerned. But, Chair, be that as it may, subsequent to receiving the comments, we had a meeting with the National Treasury where we looked at ways and means to deal with this matter. But I think the guidelines submitted by the Constitutional Court now gives us a clear indication of how the Constitutional Court see this matter, especially in regard to the question whether one should allow execution against state property. That is the provision that was declared to be unconstitutional. And if we do allow executioners against state property, the question then is how do you do that? Because the view is that one cannot allow execution just against any state property. For example, executing against the computers at a school. So we will have to look at a way in which we can possibly provide for execution, but then only against non-essential state property. In other words, you can execute against the mayor's car or the mayor's desk or something like that, but not the computers in the office. So we are looking at that. We have drafted a memorandum for our minister to get some guidelines, but we will be meeting again with National Treasury to finalize this matter and to take a final decision whether we should allow execution against state property. We did a comparative study, and it's clear that it's dealt with in different ways in different countries. Some countries do not allow execution. Some allow execution in certain cases, and in other countries, execution is open. You can execute against state property. But of course, the ideal situation is that the state should pay judgment debts. And we should avoid any execution against state property, as my colleague has indicated. but we will finalize that bill also, hopefully, within next year. But we don't want to burden the committee with too many bills at the beginning of the year because of the trafficking legislation that will be very urgent. But we will try to get that to the committee as soon as possible as well. I think those were the questions relating to legislation, Chair. As I indicated, the implementation of legislation, we will provide you with that document, and we will be happy to brief you on that. Thank you. I think I've covered all the questions relating to legislation.
Thank you. I'm sure we're going to the next phase, that's finance. Lieutenant Gaddis, yeah. Cover some. We haven't responded to all of the questions. I don't know whether we should be given that opportunity. I think there were still HR issues, and also the finance and audit that we needed to respond to. But just to finalize the report on court services on the criminal statistics and those issues that have been raised. Firstly, I think there was a question in terms of why there's such a high level of withdrawal of cases rescreening in the regional court on the backlog cases. I think the idea, I mean, also the message is that all cases that are qualified to be backlog, we're not suggesting that they are all, the screening has been sort of completed in terms of making them to be trial ready. What we have also discovered in the implementation of this case, that I mean, we had the Marcel case recently, you know, a person who has been languishing in jail for a number of years, and only to find that that case itself wasn't even ready to go to trial.
So when we make reference to that high volume of cases that we've been able to risk screen and which we found that they have not been, you know, appropriately to be ready to be placed on the roll, I think we are trying to deal with the particular kind of problem where people are languishing in jail for long, you know, periods only on matters that the investigation has not been complete. Hence, I think if you look at the numbers, that also indicates to this cluster that I think that's the biggest issue in terms of our capacity of investigation, and that leads to this kind of problems in the long run. So I just wanted to make reference to that point, Chair. I think the rest of the other, you know, cases, and as we have requested for information so that we could specifically follow on them and to enable us just to make sure that we report on those issues, Chair. Thank you very much. I think then we will have a response on the acting appointments. I think our HR can just reflect on that and then we'll go to the finance. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. The Minister has prioritized the filling of the posts, both of the Chief Litigation Officer that became vacant at the end of June, as well as that of the Chief Master. The members will just note that both of these posts require the involvement of the minister. So, especially with the change in the administration, there was some hesitancy in making the appointment just before a new minister starts. So that's about the acting appointments, and we expect that because in both cases the advertising has happened and come to a close, that the diary of the minister is allowing those appointments should have been made by the end of January. Although, of course, I'm not here saying that I will now be managing the diary of the minister. A member, Gungu Bele, before he left, raised the issue of some of the data that we report on. This has been or is a big issue, especially in the HR area, as the members will note at the back. There's part five, which is just tables and tables of numbers. Now, having realized the difficulty with the numbers, because a lot of them are based on spreadsheets, that is information that can be manipulated at will by people at different times. So you need to stress test them and keep checking them. And it's now and again, numbers come onto reports that are contradictory even at times. So to address that on the side of the human resources data, we appointed an information manager to focus just on this thing so that we are able to keep track and make sure that people are reporting the right things and not changing figures just to give an impression that things are going well. Part of the problem of the issue we expect to be addressed as we go on, and also we have already indicated to the DPSA that we would like to be one of the early adopters of the new human resources management system as it gets rolled out. It's now still being developed by the DPSA through CETA. I think that those are the questions that were raised.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think maybe firstly, I need to say that we're not proud about this qualified audit report. It's nothing to be proud of, and we are serious about it. If you look at the 0708 audit issues or the qualifications, The third-party funds as well as the asset management are the two issues that remained for this year, plus two new issues, which is the leases and the lease entitlement qualification. In relation to the third-party funds, I think I have explained, you know, what initiatives are underway to address it. The same with the assets.
Just on that one. The meeting I had just now, I think part of the problem with that issue was that the department was going forth and backward, debating with the auditor's office. And instead of solving the problem, that's what you were doing as a department, challenging some of the things that they were saying and even looking at possibly creating new structure, and instead of attending to this, but they're happy you've moved. It's not that they called me for this meeting, it happens to be here now, so I've got it right in front of me. but it suggests that because they were trying to say to me that we need to find a way in which when they come with suggestions, you don't look at changing structures, you look at the problem and try and solve that problem. So just on that one, that I've got this one here in front. It just happened in that meeting to come up. So anyway, that's it. It means we can pass it. They're happy that you've moved.
Thanks, Chief. I'm happy to provide the monthly reports that I presented EXCO, which contains all the audit action plans, the budget reports, etc., to this committee on a monthly basis, let's say by the 15th of the next month, in relation to the previous month, which is the same information we used to provide to our audit committee on a quarterly basis. So they had full access to all of those reports. In summary, in relation to what I started discussing, the comment by the auditors in terms of we've not moved with the scope of our resolutions, it relates back to the third-party funds and the assets, obviously. And we're going to change that around. In terms of the communication with the Auditor General as well as internal audit, we do have regular meetings. We've got national audit facilitators, we've got regional audit facilitators. The CFO office attends the regional contact planning as well as the reporting meetings. So I do feel that there's sufficient communication. However, I take note of the comment and the input that you've made to us, Chair, and we'll certainly work towards that. Yes, and I think lastly, we've asked the Auditor General as well this year to do a lot more interim audits. In other words, so that we don't know about a problem right at the end of the audit. Not that it's their responsibility to point it out to us, because we as management is responsible for it, but I think it would assist us to be more proactive in problem areas. Thank you.
Still on the audit, one thing they've raised with me is that occasionally the department wants your internal auditors to account to yourself. You would find that sort of attendance, which could compromise good governance, because your internal audit team, according to them, need to be some sort of independent entity so that they can point out the difficulties without having to be suspected or influenced by the people they are auditing. So those are the two feedbacks I've got now. They are not coming from me, but I think we are discussing with them those things. So, anyway, let me allow members to come in.
Just on the issue of monthly reporting, I think that maybe we could suggest a quarterly reporting. I don't see that monthly is too much. If we could consolidate it and give us quarterly reports.
I'm told we would suffer from indigestion if it was monthly.
My concern is the point about the fact that the prior year's audit findings have not been substantially addressed.
and the SCOPA resolutions have not been substantially implemented. You haven't responded to that at all. I'm not sure what is, and maybe Honourable Pitole can help. I mean, SCOPA obviously deals with the Auditor General's reports, but we are the General Oversight Committee for Justice and Constitutional Development, so I'm not sure what SCOPA demands from you, but it is, I think, also of interest to us whether you're getting qualified audits or not, and whether you're complying with the SCOPA resolution. So, I mean, to my mind, I don't know if SCOPA's asked for it, but I would like to see a response to the Auditor General's report. If SCOPA have asked for it, can you give us a copy of what you submitted to them, or when have they asked for it? If not, can you give us a copy? Because to see that you are going to comply with the last Auditor General's report. But I think the question that you haven't responded to is, why have you not complied with the SCOPA resolutions?
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to see your monthly report, because you have them anyway. They are available. I would like to follow up on that. The reason I'm saying that is that we are your portfolio committee. We are the people you can come and cry to. We need to be hands-on what is happening in the department. I don't want you to go to SCOPA at all. That is undesirable. When it happens, it is an accident. And you see, a Department of Justice must have integrity. A Department of Justice. So that the citizenry should have faith that everything is okay. I would definitely like to follow up on your monthly reports. I will not be choked by them. I love them. I love to see that one. And there is the accountant general. You know, there's a tendency with departments only to be interested in the auditor's report. You see, the auditor, once he gives a report, it does not matter how many theses you can write to explain. You are at fault, you know. The best report to follow is the accountant general's report. You must be following up your affairs in that manner. I remember way back when we actually changed the system of accounting, financial management in this country. One of the reasons that influenced it is that when we came up with the Public Finance Management Act, was the element of timeliness, timely reporting. So that is very important. In financial statements are tools of management. It does not matter how good your vision is. If you can't manage your financial assets, it's going to be very difficult for you to reach where you want to reach. So the monthly reports I would like to see. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. You want to come in?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm not aware of the input that I would like internal audit to report to myself. I have been making a noise at the audit committee that I need to see more value from the internal auditors. We need to get timely reports, etc. So I've been making that noise, but definitely not to account to the CFO's office. I fully support the independent internal audit. In relation to the quarterly report, I will surely comply to a consolidated report relating to that, as well as the monthly report then to the Honourable Member. In relation to the SCOPA and the Auditor General's input in relation to not addressing the matters, I think if you refer to the SCOPA resolution, which is on page 141 of our accounting officer report, the table there, the content there and the SCOPA resolutions relate to the third-party funds, the public-private partnership, the monies in trust issue, as well as the supply chain management, which are the two issues that again was qualified this year. So the conclusion drawn by the Auditor General is that we've not substantially addressed those resolutions or those recommendations. Therefore, that comment was made. And we fully agree with him, especially when it comes to the third-party funds issue. Thank you, Chair.
Are we done with questions, comments? Jeffrey? The thing you've been shouting about is the audit committee. What have you been saying about it? Because maybe I've not properly reflected what they told me. I remember something about audit committee. Just tell me what is it that you've got a problem with.
So the question was around what information, monthly information, any information we provide to the audit committee. And my response was that we provide the normal monthly budget expenditure review reports, we provide the audit action plan progress reports, similar information that I provide to EXCO every month. And as I've mentioned, last financial year, we met on a quarterly basis.
Chair, maybe just some additional questions. These would be more than for the acting DG. But the research section have done a summary and analysis. There are a number of questions that they raise there, which I think would be useful, a lot of which we've addressed or we've taken up, but not all of it. It would be useful to get the department's response to these points. But one of the things they do is look at the priorities that were set out in the 2008 State of the Nation Address, the political responsibilities. And the department, the annual report, just doesn't respond to that at all. There are two issues. Some of it is already dealt with in their program, but they haven't really taken it into account. But the two issues that are not mentioned are the implementation of the Victims Charter, and we always get asked on that, and can we have some kind of report as to what is happening there, and then the implementation of the additional measures from the TRC recommendations. And there, basically, it is provided for in the report. I mean, you haven't addressed it in your slide presentation, but I think what is worrying is that there doesn't seem to be much movement or any movement from 20708. That for final reparations, the 20708 report is the same as the 20809. That the medical benefits for the families of the victims is still being still consultations a year later. There's no movement. So there doesn't seem to be anything happening there. Can you give us sort of more detail with that? Then another point was, these are different points, the multilingualism. You've got at least one court per province has been designated a court in which proceedings are conducted in any of the official languages of the province. This is going to be introduced into two courts per province. Now, why does there have to be symmetry? We've already had the joke from the chairperson about the Northern Cape. Why is Northern Cape equal to KwaZulu-Natal? And the provinces differ geographically as far as whether you're likely to find a court in which everybody is speaking the same language. You're more likely to find that in KwaZulu-Natal in the Eastern Cape than you are in Gauteng, where there's a much greater mix of languages. And why does there have to be designation? I mean, I would have thought the issue should be that if the magistrate as the presiding officer finds that everybody in that court on that occasion for a criminal trial is speaking one language, which happens not to be English or Afrikaans, I think it can be either of those two, then that the proceedings in that court can go in the language that everybody is speaking. In other words, if you're in Nkandla or Singa or wherever, and you find that the accused speaks Zulu, the prosecutor speaks Zulu, the magistrate speaks Zulu, and the lawyer representing the accused speaks Zulu, the magistrate should be able to say, fine, does anyone have any objections? No. Okay, we'll conduct it in Zulu. Why can't that happen in any court in which all the parties agree? Why must you have this tortuous process of everything being translated into English? And there will be many courts in the rural areas that can be done easily. So why this sort of symmetry of saying two per province? One per province, okay, now we're going to double it, we're going to make it two per province. Why can't you give that jurisdiction up to a magistrate, I mean to the magistrate, the decision to the magistrate, to maybe ask all the parties, are they happy, and then to proceed? I'm told the issue is the problem of record, that if there's an appeal, but I mean, you know, that could be translated. Well, if the record taker is also Zulu speaking in the Msinga court, which I'm sure they probably are.
That is English speaking Zulu, not African speaking Zulu, because he was translated.
The translation can come if there's an appeal. Which saves us one translation on the record rather than everybody being translated. I think if I can just get a response on those changes. I'm sorry, Mr.
What you are saying to be suggested, you can read it. You didn't hear what Jeffrey said.
Respond to them first. I don't know about whether. I think I would ask maybe just on the multilingualism just to come in there as well. See, I think on the victim services charter, we will give, I think, a written report as part of what is the report that we have required, just to give you an update version in terms of what is happening. But suffice to say that we have now integrated that service charter together with the victim empowerment program, because, you know, social development was running a totally different program from the rest of the cluster department. So we have now matched that together, because in terms of how we address the issues of victim, we need as government to have an integrated focal point and so on. So we will give a report in terms of you know, what has been done in regard to that chain. On the issues around the TRC, also I don't have information on that. I think it is a matter that the CEO has been dealing with it. I think we'll give that additional information as well, just to give you the status in terms of what has happened as far as that. On the multilingualism, I think maybe I just allow to respond on this first. But there are challenges that it may not be as simple as that, just to ask all courts to engage in this without any policy framework on these matters. And hence, I think, this piloting that we are doing. Maybe just if...
Thanks, Chair. On why we, without allowing the court to run only language as and when that it becomes feasible, the problem is that initially the then Minister Sorti asked us to limit that so that we don't extend whatever risks that we might have, because taking into consideration that the High Courts have already delivered judgments in which they criticize the department in areas where the courts conducted proceedings in indigenous language for reasons that there is not even legal terminology which is in place to assist should the case proceed to the appeals and review stages. So that has been one of the issues that has been raised. But we agree with the member that it is something that should actually be happening in all the courts, but that is one of the issues that hampers that. We are also looking at the rules to make sure that we provide the policy in terms of which all the courts will be able to run the courts in indigenous language as required, because it is a constitutional imperative. But from a practical point of view, those are the issues that the magistrates and the judges also have raised, which the department has to respond to, whether we have the infrastructure in place to be able to deal with that, from terminology and other translation issues.
That minister was so misguided, is wrong. How do you develop these languages if you don't use them? How do you develop legal terminology in these languages? You know, in African courts, there is legal terminology for all this. We conduct trials there in the both criminal and civil, and African law.
that is done. Now, the only thing is that maybe the translator would not know the equivalent in English. Maybe that's the only thing. But I don't see us. Obviously, it's a philosophical thing, but it's not a philosophical thing. It's a constitutional thing. Now, so we're going to have to develop those languages. You know, Afrikaans is the best example of how a language is developed by usage. Where the term doesn't exist, you combine languages and create one, and you get down, you get the writers to write, and so Afrikaans is today an internationally, it can operate international up to space. How do you develop African languages if we propose that, if we give instructions, there's no legal terminology they can be used? That's totally out of order. Minister Surti was out of order. I disagree with him on that one, at least.
I'm not sure if it was the former minister or the. I thought that it was said it was high court decisions criticizing lower courts. But anyway, I think if it is high court, if it was the former minister, that's easier. If it's high court, then it becomes more bizarre.
What he said is that the courts are pronounced, and he said they must limit the time. But, I mean, it's the whole argument that you are challenging the judges about.
Sure.
I mean, our judges cannot limit. They have no right to undermine the Constitution. So they can be right on that one. That you can implement the Constitution because there's no terminology.
Yeah.
But according to them, no, it's not on.
But Chair, I'd like to, you know, maybe if we can see those judgments or the sections of those judgments, because I think it's quite bizarre, as you say. Similarly, I mean, you know, lawyers love sprouting Latin terminology, presumably on the basis that English or Afrikaans doesn't, you know, have the correct terminology, so therefore you've got to use an extinct language to do that. So similarly, I don't understand, if there isn't a phrase in an indigenous language, then use an English term or an Afrikaans term. It just seems very, very odd. And then, as you say, Chair, I mean, if everybody speaks, say, Zulu, the interpreter who's happily translating or unhappily translating everything into English for non-existent people is having to then translate this terminology and probably can't.
Thanks, and I just want to agree with you, Chair, that developing languages is not such an insurmountable task. If you consider the fact that there are so-called language boards, I'm sure those language boards can contribute a lot in the development of languages generally. And if I take my mother tongue as an example, this is one. You take the word fax. In Zulu, say it's katamis. So people are very innovative. They can always get words to suit a particular issue. So I agree with you, Chief.
Thank you. There's somebody who agrees with me.
May I contribute to the language debate, but then also ask the other questions I wanted? Yes. There are the national language boards for each language, and Pansel also runs the lexicographic units, of which there are another 9 or more. Because that's you will need those to develop some of our terminology. But Chair, I can't resist just mentioning to you, the Constitution doesn't, of course, deal with the official languages in quite the way that you are presenting. It says, as far as government is concerned, at either the national or provincial level, each one must use at least 2 languages. There is no pure injunction that everybody must use all 11. Because the challenges are very great, even in Parliament, for example.
We're using a Zulu territory or a Shangaan speaking territory, Pedi speaking territory. In that area, if there is a high court judge who says you can't use that language, it means you can't use it across the board. In other words, even in an area where the people who are in court parties, including presiding officers and officers of the court,
are speaking that language, then they are stopped by the judgment. And a minister is likely to be tempted to say, I don't want to expose my department to further attacks because now there's a division of the court. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
I actually agree with you. I think what was missing in South Africa before, after 94, was the political will. And I think that political will is now present, or seems to be present. And so and I actually agree with you, and I think we should develop languages. Yes. Please, I just want to ask you these questions. We've just been through the whole recent history, unhappy history of the standoff between the judiciary and government around the matter of the administration of the courts. And it started right after the 2004 election and lasted right up until the next election. And it seems to me we are now heading for calmer waters. Could I ask of Advocate Radman, is my impression correct that the Superior Court's bill that we will see and constitutional amendments, no doubt, dealing with the creation of the Apex Court. But am I correct in thinking that we are heading for calmer waters and that we will no longer have attempts to intrude on the administration and the institutional independence of the courts? I would appreciate a comment. But, Chair, on the same subject, I also wish to ask, on the Criminal Justice Review, because the first time I looked at that, I was quite horrified to read, and this was Advocate de Lange, of course, who drove it. I was quite horrified to read that. I quote, the CJS coordinating and management structure will flow in a seamless manner from the cabinet to each court. What is the cabinet doing running the court? And appointing a person from the executive as head of the CJS with coordination and management functions and not executive powers, which I found very small comfort in the assurance of not having executive powers. And then I see from your annual report, which of course goes up until this election, that there was a war room, an operational center war room that was run presumably by Johnny de Lange. I see in your presentation today there's reference to an interim structure and a secretariat, and no war room. And so I would just like some clarity, please. That is not either the intention or the practice that the cabinet should be running. I don't care how they run the police and the correctional services, but they can't run the courts. Can I have some assurances on that? And is the Honourable Andries, has he stepped into the role that the Honourable Johnny used to have, or is the department running this? And then, please, just my last one, on the application serving before the Constitutional Court, the Ryan Albert, whoever the gentleman is, and the Centre for the Study of Violence and others. May I ask you why the President and the Minister have joined Mr. Albert, but I've now lost my second page. Why are they joining Mr. Albert in trying to fight the ruling of the High Court? The High Court said that victims had to have the right to be heard before the President grants the pardon. And that is a very old historical position of the DP and the DA. We are in sympathy with that position. It was also written into the DRC Act. And I would just like to have an understanding, if it's possible for you to give it at this particular stage of the Constitutional Court's proceedings, of why the President and the Minister have joined Mr. Albert in this.
Honourable Smart, the word war room reminds me of something. During the elections, I was accused of running a war room from Lutuli House. Now, that sounds very familiar. It was just an ordinary office where we met everybody discussing what happened the next day. And it was discussing. Thank you. I'll just deal with the first question and I will be very brief. Yes, Honourable Smuts, we are in much calmer water. I think unanimity has been reached on the provisions of that bill as well as the constitutional amendments. The Minister has had numerous discussions with the judiciary, the heads of court, and I can safely say that there is agreement on the provisions. And
and that will also be before Parliament, possibly towards the latter part of the first half of the session of Parliament.
Thank you. I'm just saying I'm happy. But now, what about the cabinet to court control under the CJS system?
And I think it is my presumption that when I was making a report on this, the honourable member wasn't present, because I did present some progress on that, and one of which was that we now have a champion for the Criminal Justice Review. It's no longer the role of the Deputy Minister to run with it. It's now the Minister, and that responsibility has now been allocated to him. But of course, I think we have to understand the role of the coordination aspect that the Minister plays. The Minister doesn't get involved in operational issues. But his role is just to ensure that the standardization in terms of policies and so on in relation to the application and the coordination of activities of the cluster, which requires not only judges to look at issues, of course, because those also you require the involvement of correctional services, you require involvement of social development. So that role should be looked in that context, so that we don't have... I think there's always this mistake that we do in South Africa, that because our constitution does make that provision of what we call this coordinating the governance framework that is established, that the fact that we are a judiciary does not necessarily mean that you cannot, correlate and work with other spheres of government. That's the point that I wanted to make. So the role of, I think we mustn't misunderstand exactly what the minister's role is in terms of the review. Firstly, I made reference to the policy proposal in terms of the changes that have been envisaged in terms of this. I made reference to the bail regime, and which is but one of the areas that this review looks at. The other issue that I also made reference to, which is part of the progress of this, was the formulation of the protocols to ensure that there is an integration in terms of how the value chain works in the entire system and so on. So amongst that, we also do recognize that the judiciary also has to play, for example, in terms of the screening processes and the case management. That role has now been left to the judiciary to manage. There is no interference from the executive on those issues. I think that's one of the issues that I just wanted to clarify, that this does not in any way tries to impinge on the independence of the judiciary. Well, the war room, I haven't seen it, but the only thing that I know is that there is a performance measurement system that we're going to house within the Criminal Justice Review. I made reference to the development of IT system that will ensure that the departments do share the information. So one of the things that we're also developing around the Criminal Justice Review is to have a common framework of performance, because we've been severely criticized, the way we've been operating. You look at the stats that the police release. They only talk about the arrests that they've made, but it doesn't reflect in terms of how many of those cases have been successfully prosecuted in the court. So part of this performance measurement system that we're developing will be, I think, one of the issues that would ensure that the cluster, when we evaluate our performance, we evaluate generally in terms of the outcomes of the rest of the operations of the cluster as a whole. It is a system that, in fact, we have now created an office, which is within our integrated justice board, which it's a unit that is in charge of the responsibility of developing IT systems for the entire cluster. And so that's a system that will be managed by the IJS board to ensure that, there's firstly the sharing of information, but also in terms of our performance management system, that we all talk the same kind of language and so on. So, Chair, I think on the other issue, I'll leave this to the Chief Litigation Officer to respond to on the case before the Constitutional Court.
Thanks, Chair. Honourable members are inquiring about why the President and the Minister joined in the application brought by Ryan Albert in the Constitutional Court. Just a way of background. The Center for the Study of Violence, Reconciliation, Kulumani and others they initiated the application in the North Gauteng High Court against the President and the Minister of Justice for failure to sort of allow them to include victims before he makes a decision whether or not to grant a pardon. We oppose the application on the basis that is intrinsic to the interpretation of, one, the speech made by the President, two, the terms of reference for the reference group. And we lost that application by the wisdom and the words of the interpretation of Section 167 of the Constitution by the learned judge Seriti. Whilst we were considering to take the matter on appeal, because of some of the orders the Honourable Seriti made in his judgment, had some serious constitutional implications on the powers vested in the President by virtue of Section 84.2J of the Constitution. That is precisely where we decided that we should appeal, because it's going to set a precedent where in Section 84.2J can be viewed at any stage. Then at that stage, then Ryan Albert brought an application by virtue of Section 167(6) direct access to the Constitutional Court to say the applicants have no interest rather than in the public interest on that application, because Ryan Albert at that stage, before he was incarcerated, he consulted the victims, he met the victims' family, he made peace, he was supported by political organizations and so on, and therefore he sees no merit why the President should be interdicted in terms of making a decision on whether or not to grant the pardon. And when the application was brought, we then realized that it was the same issues that will have to be considered by the Supreme Court of Appeal at the Constitutional Court, and therefore we made the decision that why duplicate legal processes rather than sort of join in. But when we decided to join in, then the Justice President issued directives to allow the President and Minister an opportunity to make submissions on whether or not would it be in the public interest or whether or not to consider the application, which has been brought by direct access Section 167 of that application, precisely because we made them submissions, because the same issues that we articulated were the same basis upon which Ryan Albert brought that application.
My questions relate to court services. And my first question is, why is there no report regarding the reducing cycle time of cases where children are involved? Second question, how is the department planning to achieve the 50% finalization of cases by the family advocate now that the Children's Act prescribes compulsory mediation? Third question, how does the department intend fast-tracking establishment of the small claims courts in this financial year? Following question, how many of the 97 small claims courts still have inactive advisory boards? I would also like to get a provincial breakdown of the equality court statistics. And my last question, when will the policy for transformation of sheriffs be implemented? Thank you.
The researcher's document highlights a number of questions which are quite useful, and I don't think we've got time to go through them all now. And could I suggest that we could possibly pass it on to the department, that they could look into it and respond to us in due time? There are a number of very interesting questions there, if that would meet with your approval. Thank you.
No, I think that's fine. Let's just deal with the questions, outstanding questions, and I want to round off this meeting. I think it has achieved its objectives, more or less. Please, let's just fill the last questions, more or less. Thank you.
I just want to ask that I provide the report on the information request, because it needs
statistics and detailed information in relation to that is the chairperson allowed.
If the researchers compile they've been taking minutes, some of us have taken some notes, but I don't think they're particularly complete, but I think it's important that the issues raised are documented so that we're all clear on what the department has to respond to. So I'd want to suggest that the researchers maybe as soon as possible compile a document, circulate it to members to make input to them, and then ultimately through you, Chair, that it goes to the department wanting, raising the issues that are requiring follow-up.
Yeah, I think that's in order, so adopted. Well, I take the opportunity to thank everybody. We've had a long but very useful and exciting day. Very nice, I enjoyed it. And let's keep on trying, do our best. We're a team, operating from different sides, but we must push one another from time to time to get the best out of all of us. It's good for the country to do that. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you. Meeting closed.
So
To members, I want to check if the MP is available, maybe to start assessment. So that's tomorrow.